I'm Terry Thornton. I'm curator of education. And as always, it is my great pleasure to welcome you to Tuesday Evenings at the Modern. While we are here tonight, of course, for Tuesday Evenings at the Modern, a weekly lecture series, I'd like to take the opportunity to announce a new program, Tuesday Evenings at the Modern Films, that will run on Tuesday nights through June and July. So we're extending Tuesday Evenings. Thank you for that. Yay! You are so much my audience for this, so I wanted to introduce it to you first or announce it to you first. The particulars are almost done, but not quite, so it is not officially announced. It will be in the coming weeks, maybe a couple of weeks. You'll be seeing something either in the mail or, of course, on the website. So be on the lookout. Let's see, I wanted to let you know that as with the lecture series, this new program is going to strive to offer the opportunity to consider ideas and issues pertaining to contemporary art and or are loosely associated with the art and architecture of the modern, which is pretty much the structure of the lectures as well. I'm happy to report that Tuesday Evening Films will also be free and open to the public. And in the Tuesday evening spirit of encouraging discourse, each film will be briefly introduced and there will be an opportunity at the end for discussion. So that is the plan. And it's a bit of a pilot program, so you'll have to come and be my guinea pigs. And like I said, an official announcement with the times, the dates, and the lineup will go out in coming weeks, and then, of course, as I said, you can find it posted on the website as soon as that's all official. Next week is our last Tuesday evening lecture for the spring 2015 series, and we're going out with the New York-based artist and filmmaker Laurie Simmons, whose seminal photograph, Walking House of 1989, was recently acquired by the Modern and is currently it currently holds a prominent spot in the exhibition Framing Desire. One of the leading artists to emerge from the picture generation of the 1970s and 80s, Simmons will present her most recent photographic series as well as the feature film she's currently working on. So it should be wildly interesting, and I hope you will come back and bring a friend next Tuesday. Tonight, we are fortunate to have Editor-in-Chief of Cabinet Magazine and the Editorial Director of Cabinet Books, Sina Nahafi, back with us. Some of you may recall Sina being here in spring 2013 as a participant in a panel concerning the vibrant life and perceived challenges of today's art publications, along with representatives of Pastelogram and Triple Canopy. Sina is an important and interesting voice for art. While holding degrees in comparative literature from Princeton University, Columbia University, and New York University, he has taught at Cooper Union, Yale, and Rhode Island School of Design. He has curated and co-curated a number of exhibitions and projects, including School of Death at Family Business, which is an exhibition space initiated by Maurizio Catalan and Massimiliano Gioni, that's his last name. He was also one of the curators of, he was a curator of the last Venice Biennale, and I apologize for what I just did to his name. So they had that exhibition at Family Business, and then also a collector's album of traitors, and experientialist for the Sharjah Biennial in 2011. The Bubble at the Canadian Center for Architecture in 2010, the Museum of Projective Personality Testing for Manifesta 7, 2008, Sivan versus Finkelkraut for Documenta 2007, Philosophical Toys at Apex Art in 2005, and the traveling exhibition, The Paper Sculpture Show 2003 to 2007. Together with Jeffrey Kastner, Sina also commissioned and edited 24 essays in the catalog accompanying the 2013 Venice Biennale exhibition, The Encyclopedic Palace, which was Gioni's show. isn't that correct? Yes. I have to say that this stupendous quality and delight-inducing content of Cabinet magazine, along with the intriguing nature of each of the endeavors and accomplishments I just mentioned, has had me rapt by Sina's intellectual contribution to the discourse of art and so much more, looking for any opportunity I could possibly find to bring him back for Tuesday evenings. Well, the Modern's acquisition of a series of very special 1973 photographs, what the artist, Gordon Mata Clark, referred to as cut drawings, gave me the excuse I was looking for. It had been my hope to find someone to present a different take on the important career and work of Mata Clark, who, known for his ambitious career, including his signature architectural interventions, has attained cult status from his premature death to today. Lo and behold, I found this brilliant, unique take on an unrealized project by the artist. It was a 2005 two-part exhibition co-curated by none other than Sina Nahafi. So I extended another invitation, and Sina agreed to come back to Fort Worth and present the intricacies of Mata Clark's original project alongside a critical examination of Cabinet Magazine's exhibition titled Odd Lots, Revisiting Gordon Mata Clark's Fake Estates. So here we are. Please join me in welcoming Sina Nahafi.
Thank you all, and thank you, Terry, for such a nice, generous introduction. Massimiliano Gioni's name is hard. He goes by Max Gioni, actually. Yes, we should all know. And I just went upstairs to see the beautiful Mata Clarks, and when I was swatting by reading our own book from 10 years ago for this talk, I reread a little section about his family, you know, his Mata's son, the surrealist painter Mata's son, and his godfather was Marcel Duchamp. And so the infra form up there and the infra thin that Marcel Duchamp comes up with might have some dialogue with each other, who knows. So as I told Terry, I'm slightly wary about today's talk because after 10 years, I've gone back and reread the project that we did around Mata Clark. And it's a very fraught experience. If anyone's ever done that, I don't know if anyone's ever done that, after 10 years, read a book that you've done. It's a very unpleasant experience. And I'd like to share with you some of the unpleasantnesses in as pleasant a way as possible tonight. So this is the cover of the book that we did that went along with a show of the same title, Odd Lots, Revisiting Gordon Mata Clark's Fake Estates. And it came out in 2005. It came at the end of a two-year research project, but actually our engagement with the piece that Mata Clark had done, it started 2 years before that. And I'll tell you a little bit about the genealogy of the project, in part to tell you what I knew, what we knew at any one time, because knowledge is an important part of how the show unraveled and took place, and is also a big part of the kind of hesitation I have tonight about talking about the show. I'm not going to talk about the show itself, what happened in the galleries. There were 15 artists, some from Gordon Mata Clark's generation, some from my generation or younger, who were commissioned to respond to Mata Clark's pieces. And this was at White Columns, which is the successor to 112 Green Street, which is the nonprofit that Mata Clark founded with Jeffrey Liu. It wasn't really even a nonprofit. It was a no-profit thing. It was a kind of a very ramshackle, wonderful, spontaneous space that they ran as an exhibition space together. That space, 112 Green Street, very important in the life of Soho in the 70s, became what is now White Columns. And so this show was in White Columns in part in homage to Mata Clark. There was a second part to the show, which was in the panorama of the city of New York, as it's called, at the Queens Museum. I don't know if anyone's ever been there. If you've not, it's an amazing thing. It's a scale model of the entire five boroughs of New York City, and they update it. So every so often, they go and remove some buildings and put in the new buildings, and it's an astonishing thing. And one of the great privileges of this show was that I got to walk all over this panorama to install those little things that you see there. And those are the sites of the particular pieces of land that Gordon Matta-Clark bought for his project, about which more soon. But we also borrowed some Gordon Matta-Clarks, and you see them there in that little bay up there, and people are looking at them. So that was part two of the show. It was concurrent with the first part. And we also commissioned a number of performances on the very sites that Matta-Clark had been involved in. Sounds very mysterious, these sites. Nothing bad happened here, but there were performances that we commissioned too. So that was the show. But really what's important to me now, in some sense, and what's the subject of tonight, is what happened in this book and the kinds of claims that we made about Matta-Clark's project in this book, and what I think about them now. But this was a quote that was in the book that we got while we were researching the book from Jane Crawford. Jane Crawford is Gordon Matta-Clark's widow, was Gordon Matta-Clark's widow. They married 6 months, I think, before he died in 1978 from pancreatic cancer at the age of 35. And so when he died, she hadn't been with him during some of the work that's very famous now. She didn't know him back then. And in fact, she didn't know him when this particular project happened in 1973, which is going to be important to our story tonight. But this is something that she said about Matta-Clark. Those of you who know a little bit about the legend of Matta-Clark will know that he's a larger-than-life figure, this charismatic, handsome, very cosmopolitan guy. He spoke fluent Spanish, French, was from art royalty. He's in Soho, and he likes to cook. He has huge cauldrons. He's very social. He founds food restaurant. He is truly generous with all the artists around him, and everybody loved this guy. And it was kind of incredible to talk to his contemporaries when we were doing the project to get a sense of what this lived life was like in Soho and Matta-Clark's role in that. But one of the things about him is that even though he was an incredibly intellectual person, he was also incredibly spontaneous and fun. And this little quote from Jane Crawford is going to allow me to do something for the next 3-4 minutes, and then we'll leave it. Gordon tended to just go out and do things rather than sitting and writing up some tract about why. This is what confused many of his critics, who didn't know if he was creating art or vandalism or making some sort of joke. It wasn't until the retrospectives that people fully realized how profound and relevant his pranks were, how neatly they fit into his body of work. And in some sense, we have to look at the project of his that we're going to look at tonight and see, is it a prank? Was it meant to be a prank? What was the status of this thing? Is it an artwork? That's the ultimate question for us tonight. They're sold as artworks now. And so pranks is the operative word that I want to pull out of here. And our engagement with the Matta-Clark project came out of a kind of prank that we pulled. So in 2002, for issue 10 of the magazine, we were going to do an issue on property. We had this thought with editorial group, how much land can we buy in the United States for $500? So that was the project. That's how we got involved with Gordon Matta-Clark. Why? So we ended up buying land, or controlling land, in three parts of the universe, two of them on Earth, one of them Mars. For $325, we bought, sight unseen, some scrub land in Deming, New Mexico, and it's between the railroad and the highway there, and it's half an acre, and we bought it. The deed only says $10 or something, but it's not true. We paid $325 for it. And together with the artist Paul Ramirez Jonas, we divided up the land into Cabinetlandia, and we made this sort of fictional division of it. And this was a Mondrian painting that Paul found that fit perfectly onto the ratio of our land. So that was $325 gone. This is a live project. We've done a lot of things on it. The most fertile one, in some sense, is the fact that there's a library there, and every issue of Cabinet, all our books are there. All our archives are there, in fact. And there is a lighting. There's lighting that comes on at night, and you can even read at night if you want to. And it actually gets a lot of visitors, believe it or not. Not so this thing, on which we splurged $35. There's a guy who sells land on Mars. We bought 3.125 Selims, which turns out to be a miles redone, but that's what he calls it. And this is our bit of land there. So we blew $35 there. And that was $360. And so we had $140. Is that right? My math is not great. $140. And we're wondering, what can we do with $140? And we thought it'd be nice to have some land around us in Brooklyn, in Queens, etc. And that's when we remembered these artworks of Gordon Matta Clark's. This is one of 14 artworks that are sometimes called reality properties fake estates. And what they are is, it's a series of collages. The collage elements differ from component to component, but here's one of them. Here's a very basic one. This is the simplest one in some sense. What it is, it's a deed to a piece of land that he bought in New York City in 1973. There's a photograph of that piece of land, and then there is a map that the city still gives you. It's exactly the same map that they give you when you buy a piece of land, and it shows your property on it. And there, I don't know if you can see it, my computer couldn't be connected to the nice HDMI connector, but there's a piece of red. Matta Clark has colored in his bit of land there. And already you get a sense of why it is that these bits of land were very weird and why Matta Clark might have been interested in them. As you can tell from the piece upstairs, and if you know about his group and architecture that he was part of, he was very interested in voids and spaces that are unusable and cuts in various ways into the social urban fabric. And that's what these things are. Here's a map. Here's a schematic that we made for the show of all of them. So these are the shapes of the bits of land. And so you get a sense of how nutty they are. One of them is 1 foot wide and 330 feet long. Even the ones that are squarish and look like they might be usable are tiny, and so nobody could ever build on them. There were 14 of them. Our historical record said when we started there were 14 of them. There are now 15 of them because of our work, but there were 14 of them at the time. And you can see that they are very alluring and very useless. And we decided for the issue of the magazine that we were going to try and find them and see where they are and see who owns them now. Matta Clark still owned them. The estate owned them. So we got in touch with Jane Crawford, his widow. And she was very generous and told us where they were. We couldn't always read the exact block and lot from the bad documentation that we had access to. And she gave us the coordinates for these various things. Here are some of the ones in Queens. And we went and photographed them. So here's one of them. So this is 2.77 feet by 100 feet. And it's right down the middle of this gentleman, because he yelled at me, so I know. He's a gentleman. 2.77 feet section down the middle of his alleyway here, right bang in the middle of it, in fact. Here's another one. And this is basically this little patch just outside of the fence that you see. It's a triangular patch that goes all the way down. See that? That's one of the other ones that Matta Clark bought.
Were these expensive?
Were they expensive? That's a very good question. They were, and I'll show you. I'm going to show you many errors tonight because this project is full of errors. The documentation was full of errors, some unintentional and some perhaps intentional. They were, despite what you'll see in a second, they were between $25 and $75. And in 1973, that was not, that was some money, but it wasn't a lot of money. And we can talk about why the city of New York, which is who was auctioning off these bits of land, was selling them at all for $25. Can you imagine the administrative costs required to register this, correspond, try and collect taxes? It's not a good idea to do this, but they did it back then. Here's another one, and it's in that alleyway there. Here's another one. It's along this wall, all the way down. Here's another one along this wall on the left. And I'm going to show you the history of some of these plots and why they existed to begin with, because it's a strange history of urbanism, too. And there are a lot of errors and myths around these things when we started the project. Here's one, and there are a number like this, one of Matta Clark's favorites. This bit here is landlocked. You don't see it. It's behind that building. and it's landlocked by the various plots around it, lots around it. So you can't get into this unless you parachute in perfectly down into it. So it's utterly inaccessible. And so for Mata Clark owning real estate that was completely imaginary, if you like, or fake, in the sense that you can never enter it, was this purely conceptual relationship was especially interesting to him. So he loved these ones in particular. Here's another one down the alleyway. This, you can't see, is behind that shed in a very inaccessible way. These are the closest pictures we could get at the time in 2002. We sent a poor intern out to do this. I was too scared to do it. I was like, you do it. So she had to go do this stuff, and she came back shaking every time because people would yell at her, which I knew. So please forgive me, Christine Potts. Please forgive me. I made it sound like an opportunity for her. And then this is one of my favorites, which is basically this bush here on the right. It's the plot of land there. There are many of them. There are many of them. And this one's actually locked as well. It's behind that building. So as Christine Potts, now that we've named her, we can use her name, did that work, somebody else went, did the safer work, me and some other people, of looking into the archives of Queens, which is where most of these things are. And we realized that when Mata Clark had died in 1978, they'd sort of gone back to the city at some point, and then some people had bought some of them, but 10 of them belonged to the city. And just a little side story, one of the ones that was bought was very interesting, and when I retire, I want to go back and try and figure out what's happening with this lot. Ever since this first person bought it, he's been selling it to what I think is his brother. Every year, they go back and forth selling this piece of land to each other for $1, back and forth, every year they've been doing this. And I have no idea what they're doing, what the trick is, and what they're up to. They're up to something, but they're doing this. I don't think they're artists doing some conceptual thing. So, but anyway, 10 of them belong to the city. So we approached the city and said, we'd like to see if we can buy these bits of land. And the city came back after like a week or so and said, these are very strange bits of land. Why are you interested in them at all? And we said, nothing, just real estate. We love real estate. And they said, no, that's not good enough. Why are you interested? And we said, well, there was an artist who did this project with them at some point a long time ago, and we'd like to kind of mimic his move, as it were, by owning them. And they said, nah, we're not interested. Plus, it's just not worth it for us to charge you some little bit of money for these things, and you wouldn't want to pay real money for them. And so actually, through a friend, this came up to Bloomberg. And Bloomberg, as you know, our mayor at the time, was a huge art lover. And he personally okayed it for the city, not to sell it to us, not to lease it to us, but to license it to us, which is the least privilege that we get vis-a-vis the land. And at some point, when somebody, if you were document lovers, I could show you the deed that the city of New York sent us. It's fantastic. It says we have to have a, quote, paper relationship to the land, and it sort of defines our relationship. We're not allowed to build on there. We're allowed to visit and see it if it's legal. We don't have to go through people's houses, but we're not allowed to do anything on there. And they put all this on paper. So for $125, we leased them for one, we licensed them, I'm sorry, for 1 year. So it wasn't quite owning land, but we were happy. We're like, wow, we have 10 of the great Mata Clark properties. And then we asked three artists to do some projects on them. So on this one, Jimbo Blatchley proposed putting parking meters on them to charge all the cars parking there so he could buy a studio uptown, which he wanted. In this inaccessible one, there was a kind of a strange cottage that would be very elevated, so it'd be visible, the size of the lot. And then on this one, there was Clara Williams's Nobody postal box, so she would send mail to the nobody living there. So let's go back to these bits of these things, these collages, and look at them a little bit more carefully. As I said, there are 14 of them, and they do have slightly different ways of being in the world. This is the simplest one, as I mentioned. And they're all, by the way, very, very, they're all in major museums, basically, with an exception of a couple of them that are in private hands. So this one's owned by the Guggenheim. And let's look at what they say about it. And they say, oh, I can't read this now. It says, the economic implications of private property are at play in Matta Clark's fake estates, which incorporate these to microplots of land, slivers of peace, is that what it is? Slivers of curb size and alleyways in Queens that the artist bought at auction for $25 a piece and combined with maps and montaged images of each site. That's weird. Fascinated by the blah, 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 blah. Okay, that's nice. But that's weird already because I don't see a montaged set of images here. I don't know if you do, but I don't see anything. I just see one photograph. We'll come back to this bit of language again because there are many bits of language like this that surround this piece, and each of them, when you start to bear down on them, starts to crack. And they crack along certain lines that you can start to follow and think about how it is that a provisional project by somebody becomes an artwork decades later after the person passes away. And that's what's at stake here in some sense. So here's another one. And this one does have a collage. You see, it has. So what Matta Clark did do on most of them is that he took a picture of the thing. You've got the deed, you've got the map, you've got a picture, overview, as it were, of the thing. And then he would look down at the piece of land and photograph it and collage together the entirety of the piece of land via his photographs there. And he apparently decided that there should be two frames here, one frame keeping this away from the other. Framing is a big issue in art history, you know, the frame. So this is an interesting decision Matta Clark made about framing them. We'll come back to that maybe. Here's another one. Again, no collages. I don't know why, because he was not a shy guy. He was very confident, and the door's open. So why didn't he go down there and take pictures of that piece of land? He somehow stopped and he didn't do it. But there we go. That's one of them here. And then here's another one. And here's the fourth one, and you see that that one's been divided up into four frames. Unusual decisions for somebody like Matta Clark. If you know his work, it's very, I don't know what's the right word. He's very careful in some sense, but presentation like this is pristine in a way that's alien, I feel, to his work. So let's go back to this. We're going to go to this again and look at it one more time and go, okay, so the piece is called Reality Properties Fake Estates. That's interesting. They buy this in the... They buy this in 2000 and something. I don't remember the date. In 1994, the pieces were shown for the first time in America at Holly Solomon Gallery, and they were called Realty Positions Fake Estates. So somehow the title is in place still enough that by the time the Guggenheim buys it, there's this title. But this title had been used 2 years before the Solomon show in 1992 in Barcelona at IVAM, for a show where they were shown for the first time ever, and that's the title that was used there. So 2 years after it was used there, like this, the estate switched the title and then somehow switched it back. And in fact, there are many, many titles for this thing. But let's look further. Comma Little Alley. Is that Matta Clark's description? We don't know. Block 2497, lot 42. That's just the block and the lot that it is. Little Alley is not part of Matta Clark's name for this thing, nor is Reality Properties, nor is Fake Estates. That entire title, as we'll see, has been manufactured at one point or another in ways that are completely unstable, but then have now slowly solidified into a real title. And then let's look at the date, 1974. He buys the bits of land in 1973. So in 1974, something happened that made this into an artwork. He collaged them together in their final forms. He exhibited them, perhaps. We don't know. Something happened in 1974 that Guggenheim tells us. But they also tell us that it was posthumously assembled in 1992. So something else happened in 1992, and they felt compelled to tell us that it was assembled in 1992. Now, a lot of artworks that are big are unassembled, packed away, and then reassembled, lots and lots of them. And nobody ever says, reassembled on this date. The artwork is the artwork. You know, sometimes you pack it away. An inflatable gets deflated, and then you don't go reinflated in, you know, on this date, right? But that was somehow an event that required noting officially here. When am I going to come back to this? I can't remember. So let me tell you a few other things. It says they were bought at auction for $25. That's not right. As I told you, I have deeds. They were $25 to $75. And in fact, we know, because Matt Clark says so, he bid $300 and lost on one of them. So they weren't all $25, and he was willing to pay $300 for one of them at one auction. So that's not right. And on and on. It's not Queens either. There's one in Staten Island. So there are lots and lots of errors in this one little tiny text around Matta Clark here. And the reason why this has been very traumatic for me is that 2005, when I did this, I still had faith in archives. I still had faith in, like, when a museum tells me something, I was like, great, I'll publish that. This issue, this project shook that fundamentally, and now that I look at it, it's terrifying. Nothing out there in archival stuff that people write can be trusted, basically. Here you go. This is the beginning of a whole bunch of errors. Nancy Spector wrote this, and Nancy Spector is in our catalog, and she's read our catalog, and somehow she knows the errors, but they've not been transferred over to the right people at Guggenheim, so they're still there. All right. So when we started to do the catalog, it's not really a catalog, whatever the book is, we started to get information from two sets of people about these things. One was the people who were lending us the picture, the people who own it, and they had data for it. And one was from the estate. And we started to look at them, like, the dates are off. One says 1978, one says 1974. What date should we put on there? One has a dimension that's different than the other. One has a name that's different than the other. And who do we trust at this point? The estate, which is Jane Crawford and now, unfortunately, David Zwirner's gallery. And the other people are the people who actually own it, the museum that owns it. So what do we do? So here, for example, we decided to go with the estate consistently and note the fact that we've done so. But look at this weird one here. And almost every one of them is weird like this. This says, I don't know if you can read it, Little Alley, block, blah, 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 collage, black, 19 black and white photographs. That's what it says. The state says there are 19 black and white photographs as part of this artwork. So where are they? Because it also says there's one photograph down there, the very end, which is presumably this one. But 19 photographs that are officially part of this are not on display as part of the artwork. Maybe they're in a cupboard. Are they part of the artwork? I don't know. What happens when an artwork has part of it forever in a cupboard, right? More strangenesses. So I feel like I'm just going to tell you, like, a murder mystery that doesn't go anywhere, because it's like one failure after another. These are our failures, so I hope you won't mind me saying these things. So when we started, the city of New York said, all these lands, all these bits of land, were produced because surveyors made errors. So two surveyors start surveying from an end, you know, to two ends of the block, right? Boom, 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 boom. They get to the middle, they're like, you screwed up. You screwed up. No, there's 1 foot left over. What are we going to do? Make it its own block, right? This is what they said to us had produced all these things. So we started to look at our 10 pieces of land that we control. We got interested in their histories. So we went and looked at the maps. And one of the things we noticed right away is almost all of them were produced in the 30s and the 60s. So that means surveyors in the 30s and 60s were exceptionally dumb. You know, the 20s were great, a great age of surveying. The 40s were amazing. 30s, you know, what happened? I don't know. The influenza of 1919 killed all the great surveyors. I don't know. And maybe World War II claimed the lives of many surveyors as possible. So that didn't make sense. The surveyors were exceptionally bad those two decades. So we started to look at the history of how these things got produced. And, 8:35. Good Lord. Okay. basically, there are two stories that produced a lot of them. One of them is that Queens was farmland, and farmland is divided along elevations, the way water goes, all kinds of things that have nothing to do with the grid. And so when you put the urban grid on top of farmland, and let's say this farm is not sold to you, but this farm is, and you put your grid on there, you're going to have strange contours at the edges. And that's what produces a lot of the ones in the 30s, which is when the grid's put on Queens. And this actually is produced via that kind of mechanism. This one is produced via the second kind of mechanism in the 60s. When Moses comes to build his highways, they, through eminent domain, cut through blocks at strange angles. And so that creates a lot of triangular shapes at the edges. So it's the difference between a, what is that shape? Trapezoid? No, I don't know. But you know what I mean. The non-rectangular extra bit of triangle left over. So that's when you get a lot of the triangular shapes, and that's the history of one of them there. And then the third one will show you the irrationality of the whole thing, because this is an easement. That's the alleyway where our friend wanted to install the parking meters. So if you look at it carefully, you'll see the city goes, you should have an easement of 10 feet over here and an easement of 10 feet over there. And they take the 10 foot out of the blocks of the top there, right? I wish I had a pointer. But they take 10 feet out of those. They want their easements to be 10 foot and then 10 foot, a 20 foot easement. And that leaves 2.33 feet at the end there. So can anybody explain to me why didn't they not take a little less from the north and just get a 20-foot easement, right, that ends nicely on the south? But they didn't do that, and they left a 2.33-foot thing all the way across. That doesn't make sense. And in fact, none of them make sense, because if you've got a little bit of land left over, why don't you just give it to the guy who has the garden right there, right? Why don't you just say, put some tulips there in this little thing? But you've stuck with a strange bit of land nobody can access, nobody wants to buy, and it's on your roll. So why do they even want to try and sell these things in 1973? So the city of New York is basically bankrupt, right? It's going to reach its end point in 1975. Manufacturing's going away. All the Fortune 500 companies are going away. There are a lot of the middle class are going. It's exactly what creates the conditions for Gordon Matta-Clark and the Soho crowd to move in there. In fact, it's a great time for art, but a terrible time for the city. And the city at that time doesn't think like a corporation the way it does now. I've seen one of the letters that they've sent to Matta-Clark to try and collect 23 cents in taxes. And it's back and forth for the 23 cents. I mean, you know, imagine how much time that took, right? So 1973, they're trying to sell everything they can, everything they can. And a lot of things are going for a dollar. So Alana Heiss, who's the founder of PS1, is going to these auctions. And either she tells Matta-Clark, or Matta-Clark goes with her, because they're both really interested in real estate, like a lot of those Soho artists. They're interested in real estate for various reasons. Matta-Clark, because he wants to trash them in various ways. And Alana Heiss is looking for PS1. So they go to a bunch of auctions in 1973, and there is where Matta-Clark sees that these strange bits of land, there are thousands of them, by the way, not like 15 of them or anything like that, thousands of them across Brooklyn, Queens, Staten Island, are being sold. And that's when he first bumps into them. And he goes to two auctions. The first one, he buys five plots of land. And then for the second one, he's too busy, he's away, and he sends his studio assistant and good friend Manfred Hecht to buy them. And I have a quote from Manfred Hecht, so just so you get a sense of like how provisional everything was. I mean, how provisional everything was so many of the people who knew him at the time, two of them, when we called them, they're like, do you understand we were stoned the whole time? We were asking questions about like how we made a decision now, like in 1973. You know, he's like, the wrong question, man. So, yeah. So that was a real part of the, but this is how Manfred Hecht, Gordon Matta-Clark, basically said, get whatever comes up in the slivers in the $25 to $75 range. Because I purchased the properties, Manfred Hecht, they were in my name. He lost interest in the project and didn't do anything on them. And I ended up facing back taxes and foreclosure of the property. Poor Manfred Hecht. He's like, screwed because of these things, right? And tax is a real issue because even though it's like a few dollars, these people don't have a few dollars apparently, or they don't care to gather their few dollars. So we found these in the estate. These are unpaid tax bills, right? But Hecht finally passes off the 10 lots to Matta Clark. So Matta Clark now has 15, and we'll come back to the 14-15 in a second. But he has 15 of them now. And what happens is that there was one piece of documentation that we have that Matta Clark wrote to his friends in Soho about these bits of land. It's very cryptic and very short. I'll show that to you. Strangely enough, the biggest statement we have from Matta Clark about these bits of land comes from the New York Times, because there's a guy who's there when the auctions are happening, the first one that Matta Clark is at when he buys the five. And he writes a thing. He writes a piece in the New York Times, which none of the people in the estate knew about. So this statement that Matta Clark says about what he wants to do with these bits of land, which is in fact the closest thing they'll find to what they do with it later, is something they didn't know about. So, but here we go. What does he say? A guy called Dan Karlinski writes this piece in the real estate section of the New York Times. The piece is called Sliver Buyers Have a Field Day at City Sales. And the most exclusive testimony comes from Gordon Matta Clark, a 28-year-old Soho artist who, quote, walked away with five pieces of New York, four in Queens, one in Staten Island. Matta Clark said, I got more than I expected, and I'm very happy about it. Mr. Matta Clark says he intends to use his new properties and works of art he will create during the next several months. The artworks will consist of three parts: a written documentation of the piece of land, including exact dimensions and location, and perhaps a list of weeds growing there. Don't forget, this is a guy who's making up stuff on the spot to the reporter, right? It's not like a full-scale photograph of the property, tick, you know, and the property itself. So when you bought the piece, you're supposed to get the land, right? Not tick. No, we don't have those anymore to sell you when you buy the piece. The first two parts will be displayed in a gallery, and buyers of the art will purchase the deed buy the deed to the land. Yeah? So that's what he said when he walked out the first auction, excited to have had these five. But he changed his mind over the years, and there are lots of other statements, little bits here and there, about what he might want to do with them, and we'll go to those in a second. But let's think about the tax stuff. So what happens is that Matta Clark doesn't care to pay these taxes. He has a friend, a wonderful friend called Norman Fisher. And Norman, he's bored with them, according to his closest friend at the time. He doesn't know what to do with them. He brings them out at parties and shows it to people. He doesn't know what to do with them. He gives them to Norman Fisher. Norman Fisher loves these things. He can't believe that Matta Clark is about to give them up and give them back to the city. So he keeps them, and he shows them to people at parties again and again. We have lots of evidence of that. And let me read you this little quote here. I should have numbered these. Good Lord. What happened here? No. It's just me. I should have numbered these. Here's that. Okay. There it is. This is Tina Gerard, who is the founder of Food with Matta Clark, the kind of strange restaurant that they ran. And in 1982, when I showed up in New York for the first time, I wasn't in the art world. I didn't care for art. I was living in New Jersey, and I would come to Soho, I don't know, just to see stuff. And I would go to Food, because I grew up in England where the bread is very thin, and of Food, the bread was really thick, and I loved this. I was like, wow, this is amazing. This is America. So I used to go there, not knowing it's actually Matta Clark's restaurants, etc. But so Tina Gerard, who founded Food, says, fake estates wound up in Norman Fisher's collection because Gordon didn't know what to do with it. It became tedious to the point where he was letting it go. And Norman said, wait, I'll take it. I'll pay the damn taxes. So if it was exhibited at all, ever, and exhibition's going to be a big part of this, right? It was in the salon of Norman Fisher. I remember vividly the cardboard box that would be pulled out and pick out one photograph or document or the other so you could visit the pieces, because Norman would take one out and read, talk about it, and say, do something with it. Right? Like, owning them wasn't enough. Do something with it. Blah, blah, blah. Norman Fisher dies in 77. One of his last things is, this box has to go back to Matta Clark. It takes a while. Matta Clark dies very soon after that. So in 1979 or 1980, the box comes to Gordon Matta Clark's widow. She opens it, and she goes, oh, my God, what the hell is all this legal stuff? Like, deeds and all this stuff. She closes it, puts it away, forgets about it. That's the end of the story for a long, long time. Until the rainy day that she was waiting for came in the form of Corinne de Saran, who's a curator at Barcelona's IBAM. And she comes, and she opens the box and goes, what are these? And Jane goes, I don't know. I have no idea. She goes, these look important. These look interesting. And so she says, we should exhibit these things. And so Jane Crawford and her husband now, Robert Fiore, the filmmaker, you know, he shot Spiral Jetty, you know, they went out to the bits of land to try and find these bits of land and correlate them, right? They've got a box full of, look, grass, 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 grass. Which grass is what? You know, you have no idea. So they go and try and correlate them. They had the negatives, and most of the negatives, so that was helpful. So that's what they did. And here's kind of a funny little thing. So she says, sorry, this was a, no, I should have numbered these things. I didn't number them. Okay. Here we go. I think it's here. Bear with me. Because this is an amazing quote. We're in the realm of minutia here, right? Uh-huh. But hey, the devil's in the details. So here we go. I assembled the sequential black and white photographs of the ground in the order determined by the photos themselves and then fastened them together with archival tape. The supporting materials, such as the deeds, maps, and location photographs, I kept separate. Then over the next 3 months, my husband, Robert Fiore, and I drove around Queens trying to match up the different sites to the strings of photographs. In one case, we found that Gordon had photographed the wrong location. He thought he'd purchased a strip of curb by the Long Island Expressway when he'd actually acquired a little triangle of grass round the corner, which we know which block and lot that is. So that's in there as one of the artworks, is the wrong set of photographs to a wrong piece of land. And then, this is interesting here, because we asked her, in terms of the subtitles, remember that like little subtitle that Guggenheim had? One of them was called, for example, Maspeth Onions. One of them is called Jamaica Curb. And we asked her, who came up with those? And she said, those are my names. And we said, was there something specific in the photographs that clued you in? And she said, there were onions in Maspeth Onions when we went there. So there weren't onions in Matta Clark's time, but just onions when they went there. Although the photograph itself is empty. And there was one that we called Driveway with Dog. Let's assume the dog was not there in 1973. So you got a driveway with dog with no dog in it now. And one was the driveway without a dog. It's a great naming system. The thing that is missing. There was also no naked man with an umbrella, and there was no cucumber on a riding a tomato. I know there are lots of things that weren't there, but there was no dog there either. So I'm trying to give you through these little bits a sense of the contingencies that had to come in order to produce these things, from the titling to the decision to collage them to the decision that they were an artwork as opposed to something he wasn't sure what to do with. And here's more. When we talked to the Zwerner Gallery, who were very, very against scholarship of any kind, you know, basically is how I can put it mildly. They actually actively tried to block our project. And Jane Crawford is the person who said, give them the photographs, give them the archive, give them this. And this is the only reason why I might like to have this podcast go out, so that bit goes out. No, that bit goes out, because they were really a nightmare. But when you talk to them, it's clear that the artist intended this, and it was exhibited in this way in his lifetime. And Jane also says, and Jane has, you know, the best of intentions, so This is about the fuzziness of history solidifying in certain ways into a solid narrative. And as a solid narrative that closes, in some sense, one of the most fecund and open periods that we have of art making, where the difference between a project, artwork, performance, what I'm doing, all of that wasn't part of the vocabulary then, right? So that openness gets closed down for certain reasons, financial being one of them for sure. Why these 14 artworks and not one artwork? Hey, you can get a lot more money for 14 artworks, can't you, than one big one, you know? So there are a whole lot of reasons to go in there, but exhibition history is a big part of this, right? So Jane said, a couple of his friends, including Carol Gooden, who's his close friend who opened Food with him, remembered that the material actually had been exhibited at 112 Green Street in 1974. We interviewed Carol Gooden, and she says, at first Gordon didn't know what he wanted to do with the slivers. They were in his mind abstract forms, like the forms he was cutting out of floors and walls. He was starting to do that just at this time, in 1973. He also thought of them as something he might build upon. So here's another idea. Like the tree garden on the raft to float down the Hudson River. I do believe the photographs and the graphic descriptions were exhibited perhaps at 112 Green Street, but she's not so sure, as sure as Jane Crawford thought she was. And then we talked to Jeffrey Liu, who ran 112 Green Street, and he says, it's conceivable that it would have been shown there, but I don't remember it personally. So, no, not so sure where it was shown at all, ever, perhaps. And so we end with a quote from Jane, which I think should be the title of this project and perhaps all kinds of art history projects. She says, what he did with the documentation, no one remembers. So that means there was an artwork, but the documentation's missing. But I don't know. Was there a show? Whenever I need to find out about a piece of Gordon's, I always call his close friends from that period. I'm sure someone probably told me that the documentation was shown with the collages. So that's a wonderful sentence, right? I'm sure someone probably told me. That's like, if you want to press down, I'm a literature person, you know, and we were taught to read carefully and put pressure on words and see what moves and what the rhetoric is. And that's like, you know, that's like, I'm sure someone probably told me. And then let's go back to the titles. We asked her a little bit about the titles, some more. And we said, you know, we've seen fake estate, fake estates, realty positions, fake estates, reality properties, fake estates. Where do these things come from? And she said, I took the titles from what he'd written on his negatives in the archives. On some, it would be one title, and on others, another title, and a misspelling sometimes. I put all of them to see what would stick. But I never came up with the stuff myself. It was always what was in the file. Now they're called reality properties, fake estates. That's become the official title. But in 1985, before the Barcelona curator shows up and opens the box, somebody else actually was in the box. That's curator Mary Jane Jacob, who did a show on Mata Clark in 85. And she says, she showed, in fact, one of them, and she called it fake estate, singular. And she says, I didn't find any notes about other titles other than fake estate in there. The map was in the estate. I would have seen it and selected this one from several in the files. I went through everything, every crumb, shred of paper, photo, negative, so that this show in a book became essentially a catalog resume. If I had come across other titles for this work, I would have listed them, as I did with the other works. I did not find them. Still, that doesn't mean Gordon didn't have other titles, working titles, alternate titles. If you have found some more of a fake estate, then they would function the same way. But we haven't found anything, and there's a contradictory sort of moment here about the name of these things. And then one last little bit, and then oh my goodness, it's 8:55. I'm sorry. We found a friend of his called Jaime Davidovich, who lived right across the street from him on Wooster Street. And he went with him one day to film Mata Clark claiming his bits of land. This is actually 1975, so a year and something after he's bought them, right? So there he is. And here he is, looking at the bits of land and trying to figure out where what it is that he owns. This is a Portapak, by the way, like a very huge, heavy, early video camera, right? Here he is. This is actually the bit of land with the parking meters. And he's marking out his little estate there. And then, when we were talking to Jaime, we said, so Jane told us that there were 14 bits of land, but she'd found a few pieces of stuff in the box that she couldn't account for. This seemed like a 15 thing, but she ignored them because she couldn't make sense of them. And he goes, ah, because there are 15 of them, and that's the official number now. That last one, that triangle, was missing before. And he goes, were they missing the map and a deed? And we said, yes. And he goes, I have them. And here, he had them. So what he had is the collage that he showed us, and this is the map. And he said Matta Clark wanted to do installations on these things. So he and I went out to that 15th one. He gifted it to me and said, why don't you make an installation? Except they couldn't. This triangle is at a triangle in a corner of a huge warehouse. And you have to ask the people in the warehouse if you can go there. And we couldn't get in. They yelled at us and threw us out. But they got a little further in, but then they couldn't get to do what they wanted to do there. So that's where the 15th one was. And that sort of bit of history got back there. And this is what we found, a little folder that Matta Clark had for his real estates, or fake estates, or whatever we want to call them. And he had a little note in there. And this is like basically all there is of this project, from which a lot has been made, right? You see this small piece of New York up there. One thing he says other than the New York Times thing, on paper, I mean. And then he writes this amazing letter. I mean, if we had an hour. This is sent to his group called An Architecture that he was part of, with Laurie Anderson and Carol Gooden and Heisner and, no, sorry, not Heisner, I mean Jeff Nonis and other people like this. And he has tons of ideas that he puts on this little thing that he sent them from, I think, where is it from, France? I can't quite tell. He's abroad at the time. And so it's just stuff full of ideas for them to explore. And on this page, I'm sorry, it's very hard to read.
Yeah, it's one of those old-fashioned aerograms. Uh-huh. Do you remember that?
Yes.
Yeah, that's what that is. And here it says, there it is.
Number 7, all the way down, almost like two-thirds of the way down on the left. Fake estate.
Yeah.
Property slivers with some projected ideas for them. That's what he sends them for them to discuss.
And this is his sort of closest group of friends with whom he's doing a lot of collaborative projects. And so this is his sort of thinking at one point around them. And so we can go back and look at this and go, if every document that we have about this work has this many errors, that's one problem. And then how is it that slowly these things became 14 artworks that are solidified with an exhibition history that we are sure of? Matta Clark showed them for sure. We know this somehow, although there's no evidence for this. It has a title, although we don't really know the title, and on and on and on and on. And then I guess I should tell you, I mean, every project has these things in it, right? I mean, this is not unusual, although it was very unusual to find so many weird things around one project, I think. But what was really discombobulating for me, reading this 10 years later and trying to see what we had done, was that all the pieces of evidence that I've shown you are in our book, but we never correlated them together and put more pressure on the myths that have been spun around this. So one bit of information is here, one bit is here, one bit is here, and we kind of knew they were there, and we didn't quite do it. We didn't quite like put them together and do the next step, you know? And we didn't have time. There were pressures on us institutionally to come up with certain things, etc. But, you know, what I'm afraid of is that, and now I'm 50, I should think about this more, is that some element of cowardice was also there. Cowardice in not saying to the very nice people helping us, is this really true? We have evidence to the contrary. Or saying, this is not true at all. Let's push it further, you know? And that sort of element of combativeness that would have been required to push some of these things to the next level, we didn't have. I don't know what we want to call that lack of combativeness, but cowardice might be one way to think about it. Maybe there are other names for it, which is why it's been very hard for me to reread the book, actually, for this talk. So I'll stop there. Thank you. Questions, but if there are a couple, I'm happy to answer them. And yeah. I don't have answers. Yes, as you can see, I don't have answers. I just have more questions.
We don't have a lot of time, but I am curious about some of the artists. So this was your experience in doing the research became almost as much about the falseness of the material, or that it was just not altogether provable.
Yeah, I mean, and some of it, as I said, is just the energy of that period. I mean, they weren't interested in documenting their work.
Yeah.
You know, Jeffrey Liu, we finally reached him he was about to board a plane in Europe, and he's the guy who said, listen, you have to understand, Gordon and I were stoned all the time. Everyone was stoned. We were doing all this stuff. We were drunk every night. I mean, your questions are just like, you know, and I understand that. And it's kind of, here you are, the nerd, you know, years later trying to pick up the fragments. And the fragments are there because it was a productive, wild, wonderful scene, right? So some of the lack of information is because of that. And that's just that, you know. But what is interesting to me is how the lacunae and the opennesses have been sealed up since then, after his death, for reasons that I think neither do a service to that open fecundity of that period, right? Nor allow scholarship to see those lacunae anymore, because the narratives are sealed, you know, signed, sealed, and delivered in a very particular way, which is great for art history of a certain kind. If you want your narratives done right, you know, there you go. The Guggenheim has it, and everybody else has it. And it's also great, to truth be told, for selling them. I mean, how can you sell a work? And the Guggenheim, I should say, was very upset. They had huge discussions, and we know about this, it's public, when they found out that they're posthumously assembled. Because what does that mean? How many decisions were made? There are lots of other decisions I didn't tell you that were made. The strips of photographs that you see that are all continuous, they're not actually continuous. There are some missing in the middle. The decision had to be made, do we jump and show the fact that there are no photographs there? Matta Clark either didn't take them, or they're lost, or do we pretend the land was here? That's what they did. So all these kinds of decisions that were made are real decisions about an artwork, right? From the title to the blah, blah, blah. And the mood of it, two frames, three frames, those are pristine, very anti-Matta Clark, I feel, decisions about presentation. So when the Guggenheim found out, they had a lot of discussions with a number of scholars, including Pamela Lee, who had written an amazing book on, her dissertation was on Matta Clark, and asked her advice, like, is this a work? And Pamela, in an interview, I didn't read this, I had this here, said to us, I wish I'd told them at the time that you should just think of them as conceptual documents and not an artwork. And in some sense, that gives you more free rein. But who wants to buy conceptual documents for a lot of money, you know? And who would buy them again from the Guggenheim if they ever decide to sell them, right? Conceptual documents. So, but that was her feeling. She wished she'd said that, she said, to them, more than, this is an artwork or it's an interesting project. Which it is. It's an interesting project. I should say, because this is not clear, I love this project. I think it's an amazing thing. I don't think it's an artwork by the criteria that the market sets up. I don't care. But the market cares, and the market has created this myth around them. So I love this project, and we spent, you know, my goodness, 2.5 years in the bowels of archives and all kinds of stuff doing this. And I wouldn't have done that if I didn't love the project. So I hope that came through. Maybe it didn't, because I was being a curmudgeon about the various things tonight. So.
What were some of the artists, different artists' responses, the work that you showed at White Column?
The artists of his generation, you mean?
Well, both, you know, the ones that you invited to do projects.
Yeah.
What seemed to be the energy or responses there kind of generally?
I see. Well, you know, I don't know anybody who doesn't, in some sense, worship Mata Clark, you know. Everybody admires him for one reason or another. So everybody was so excited to be in the show and think about responding to this piece. That we asked him to respond to this piece, right? And there were... Yeah, we told them about it. We told them about it. We told them what we knew about it at the time, which changed again and again, as you know. So Dennis Oppenheim was in the show. Meryl Euclides was in the show. And these two artists who showed with Mata Clark and knew him well. And then younger artists, sort of that my generation, Mark Dion was in the show, for example. And then younger, one of my students from RISD was in the show. So it was really three generations of artists in the show together. I think the show was good. I don't know. I think it was interesting. I think that the work on urbanism that we did, actually, another intern who's now an incredible architect, Tal Shorey, did a lot of that work, and he did amazing work. I mean, the city of New York, when we went back to them, they're like, what is this? Is this true? We're like, yes, this is your own maps. Like, not surveyor's errors, you know? Not surveyor's errors. In that New York Times article, Mata Clark says, architect's errors, because he hated architects. He studied architecture at Cornell, and he hated architects. So he says they're architect's errors. It's like, okay, architects could have made these errors, but sorry, yeah.
I just wondered if you could tell us more about Mata Clark's relationship to, you know, the whole property is a fiction in a sense, right? And so I know a lot of artists have, through the years, had a lot of concerns about the commodification of their work and so on. And I'm just wondering, you know, forgive my ignorance, but did he sell much in the way of objects during his lifetime? And what was his relation to that? I think a lot of artists have sort of a devious relationship to it. You know, they will do things because they need to make a living, but then there's other things that they're doing on the side that may be more important to them or something.
Yeah, I don't know the answer to that. I know a little bit about, like, you know, so, for example, Splitting, which is the piece, his famous piece that he did in Englewood, New Jersey, you know, that was going to be demolished, so the piece is gone. But there's photographs of it. You know, there's the one amazing photograph of it. There is a video of it, too. Is that sold as an artwork? I can't quite tell. I don't know. And the piece that he did at Niagara, Bingo, you know, the sections from the edges of that are available and bought, you know, but the piece is gone. So what kind of move is that to remove the corners of the building you were demolishing and bring them back as something? I don't quite know. I don't know the answer to that. I mean, when he does Day's End, which is in 1975, he does it illegally in the pier, you know, on the west, one of the west piers in Manhattan. And the city are after him at this time. They're like, what are you doing to these buildings illegally? So he has to flee for 1 year to Europe. And he's there until the lawsuit against him for $1 million is dropped. And there he does a lot of his wonderful work. Antwerp, et cetera, is all there. So I don't know how much he was selling. I mean, the funny thing about Mata Clark is that he's living like all these other artists there, but he's actually very wealthy, I mean, through his father, right? I mean, he has access to money. And, you know, Tina Gerard, I think, says, you have to understand, he's a guy who did stuff. He had a truck. Like, none of us had trucks, but he had a truck. Like, you know, and had cauldrons to make soup in. And, you know, he was generous in part because he had more money than the other people, you know. I mean, Mata had a huge estate. And then the other, I mean, well. So I don't know the answer to how much money he made off his work, artwork. I don't think a whole lot. His work really took off later. In 1994, when Holly Solomon shows these things, they think of them as having no commercial value. They do a show because they love this thing. They don't think anyone's going to buy them. And I don't know how many pieces sold. Lance Fung, who's the director, buys one of them to prove a point, basically says. But I don't know how many other pieces sold. He says in the catalog, in our catalog, museums just weren't interested in it. So I don't even know if anything sold except the one to Lance Fung in 1994, you know? Yeah. I don't know the answer to that. I should know, but I don't.
What do you think that Mata Clark would have made of Odd Lots, of your project?
Oh, yeah. We talk about this in the catalog because we wanted to originally commission artworks on the pieces of land. Mm-hmm. And then we thought, that's silly. He didn't do that. But then we read that he wanted to do that. And then that's why we ended up doing those little performances. We commissioned a number of people to do performances. They just went on land and came out to leave a very light footprint on it. I don't know. We admire, you know, this is embarrassing. After 2 years of spending, we would call him Gordon at the end. Like, would Gordon have, you know, it's like absurd, you know? So that's how much charisma the guy has that, you know, you kind of want Gordon to like you. I think he was very interested in archives and in the boring stuff. He was. He was like, had this gung-ho, you know, tool belt conceptualist is sort of his thing, right? You know, shirt off, saw and all that. But he also, Alana Heiss talks about this, when they used to go to the archives, to the New York City Department of Buildings, don't forget this loft culture, they're illegally living in all these lofts. And in fact, Mata Clark has bought and flipped a bunch of lofts at this point. And like a lot of those people is buying stuff and selling them. So they're at the New York City Department of Buildings all the time trying to deal with its laws, understand its stuff. Everybody hates going there except Mata Clark. Mata Clark loves that. And Mata Clark is in the archives there looking at the stuff all the time, according to his friend. So the nebbishy bits of this, which in some sense people would go, ugh, here's this force of nature and you're like the nebbish picking up the pieces. He was a bit of a nebbish himself, let's just put it that way. He could be a nebbish, so I hope he would have liked the nebbishy bits. I don't know. Not sure.
Yeah, well.
Thank you. Yeah.
What kind of feedback have you received from historians outside of art historians on this type of project? Because historians seem to have this type of problem all the time. Say the Bastille the prison for the Salem witch trials, things like that.
Yeah. I think that the show got a lot of critical the critical reception in the art world was huge, and art history too. I mean, you know, we've been in touch with major people who've worked on him because of the show. I don't know one historian outside of art history who was interested in it, to be honest. I mean, you don't know. You put out a book, it's sold out. We sold 3,000 copies of it. Did any historians buy it? I don't know. Maybe they did, but they never wrote us. The art historians and art critics wrote us, but so I don't know.
But it seems a problem.
It's a problem, yeah.
Just for history itself.
For sure, for sure. And, I mean, instead of the art world financial market forces, you can put nationalism and all kinds of other forces that distort narratives and history proper, right? I mean, you know, you have other forces instead, right? It's just substitute another one, for sure. For sure. Yeah, it's not unusual, it's just, yeah. Do we have time? Or?
Yeah, we'll take one more.
Okay.
In addition to the buying and selling of these lots, didn't he also work on some of the buildings himself in terms of, you know, rehabilitating some of them, subdividing them, and actually get into doing construction?
You mean in Soho?
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, he was
and
part of this.
Led to him, you know, actually cutting into the buildings, too.
Yeah, I mean, he was, An Architecture, which is the group he was and was interested in sort of, you know, undoing architecture in various ways. Let's leave it at that. And they were interested in voids, unusable spaces, etc. But they were also interested in taking over unusable spaces and using them temporarily. So he bought some places and fixed them and sold them. He would go into places that were not used and do artworks in them, you know, like Days End is the most famous one. And illegally, he would go in there and do things. His good friend Alana Heiss, who founds PS1 at that time, is running Art and Urban Resources, whose job it is to basically legally find these New York is a wasteland at this point, parts of it, right? Find these buildings that no one's using and do art shows in there and use them as studios, etc. So they're all interested in this stuff. They're all interested in real estate in a funny way, like deeply interested, you know. And across the street from him is Fluxus Building Number 2. So George Michunas is sort of doing all that stuff in Soho. Jaime Davidovich, the guy who did the video piece that I showed you, lives in Fluxus Building Number 2. It's the second one that George Michunas, the founder of Fluxus, took and redid and tried to make Soho into the sort of artist area. So they're all deeply interested. But something else I wanted to say about your question. There was something else.
Like that physically got him involved in working on the buildings, cutting and rearranging things, and maybe that led into the...
Right. Yeah, I mean, all of that comes after 73. All the splitting building, all of that comes after this moment. And sometimes there's a prelude to it. Oh, I was going to just tell you one quick story. When I was in the Canadian Center for Architecture doing some research on something else, I thought, for a break, I'll look in the Matta Clark archive, and I shouldn't have done that because it derailed my other project, and I spent 3.5 days reading the correspondence between him, his father, his mother, and his twin brother, Sebastian, who committed suicide basically in front of Matta Clark in 1976. So Matta Clark was living on Wooster Street, and he goes out to get lunch, and Sebastian is there. And when he comes back, Sebastian has thrown himself out the window and is dead on a car in front of him. And Sebastian is his twin brother who comes out about half an hour, I think it is, later. And all his life, Sebastian, who was also an artist, but not a good one, wanted to be like his brother. And it's incredibly sad because he's writing all these letters to Matta Clark saying, your lesser brother. Writes to his mother saying, your lesser son, your second son. It's just this enormous inferiority complex that the parents are very afraid of, and then finally in 76 he kills himself. But this is the important thing. In 1973, when Matta Clark is beginning to work on splitting, when you read the letters to Sebastian, he talks about, like, you need to take yourself away a little bit from me and not sort of have this relationship. They're not living together, not even in the same city, but you need to sort of split away from me a little bit, and in some sense we need to kind of... So splitting, this house divided, in some sense, when I was reading that, I was like, this is about him and his brother in some strange way, you know, because the metaphors are the same, and the word comes up again and again in the letters, and so the work kind of comes back in strange ways to his family history too, I think. But that's another story. So, thank you so much.
Thank you.